I my sense is that the sort of purely execution focused designer is going to be less relevant as time goes on. If the thing that you're good at is you can pump out ideas with like some level of craft and quality, but they're very straightforward ideas, I think very quickly that is going to be commoditized. And so being able to own this more abstract thinking is, I think, a much more valuable skill and much more difficult skill to develop. But I think it will be the thing that differentiates thoughtful, creative designers from just like a PM with Figma, you know?
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Remember the looping video app Vine? Well, today we get to hear from their old head of design, Rich Arnold. He shares lessons learned at Vine and also designing on the early Instagram Stories team. We get into how you can grow as a creative problem solver and talk about specific storytelling tactics that you can use to get buy-in for your ideas. But first, I wanted to ask Rich, why did he join Vine in the first place, and what were some of the things that made that early design culture so unique?
The thing you run into working in design studios, at least at the time, I don't know how much this is still the case today, but at least at the time, you were very much at the whim of, you know, whoever like your contact was at the company. It was very hard to like get deep into the problems they were solving. A lot of times you would maybe disagree even with the premise of the stuff you're working on, but you're not in a position to push back on that. You kind of just have to accept, you know, assume the position of whatever idea they have and then trying to find the best execution of it. And it's like, at some point that becomes a very, very exhausting exercise, and you feel very like limited in what you can achieve. So the idea of moving in-house was interesting to me for a bit. Specifically Vine, I was very interested in because I've always been interested in these like weird, fun products. Those are the things I got into design to make. And Vine is maybe the weirdest, most fun product I'll ever get to work on. In particular, because it like existed in a period of time in tech where I joke about this with friends, but there was a period of New York tech where like the money had arrived and like there were fun things here, but the grown-ups weren't here yet. And so things like Vine and Tumblr and all this stuff was popping in New York. And it was like, that was like a fun opportunity to actually work in that space.
Can you talk a little bit more about like the design culture? Because I think Vine as a company and as a product has such a nostalgic place in our hearts. Like we kind of feel that, oh, those were the glory days too. Can you give us like a little lens? Like what was it like behind closed doors? How did you operate and what was the vibe at that company?
When I joined, of the three founders, two had left at that point, but the founder that was left was the design founder, which is Russ, after Vine, he went on to do HQ. Russ, I think, is a visionary in a lot of respects. I think he's a very, very, very creative person, especially in his ability to come up with like the 0 to 1 ideas. In that respect, design was able to function pretty independently there. And I think the process of working there was definitely a lot less formalized than what we would end up doing later on at places like Instagram, where it would just be, you know, Russ would have an idea where like someone in design would have an idea for just a weird, fun thing that we think we'd have a good time playing with. And then we would just go make that. And it was definitely a lot less of a, you know, formalized review and planning process. It was definitely a lot, you know, looser. Probably going back to what I was saying before about like the grownups hadn't gotten there yet, you know. But the team, like at that point in time, like that really like appealed to me. This idea of feeling like an artist who had been dropped into a tech company. It was definitely this somewhat nice transition from the studio working model, which is also a little loose and, you know, you're kind of just trying to find the most fun thing or like the coolest thing to make, into more traditional like product design, capital P, capital D.
You know, you mentioned some of the differences between Instagram and Vine. And when you were writing to me, you said that Instagram felt more like a grown-up organization.
Yes.
Can you unpack that a little bit? Like, what were some of the differences between these two teams? And specifically, how was that reflected in the design culture?
At Vine, you know, the process of like building and shipping things was really just incredibly ad hoc. Like the idea of like doing a design review, you know, to build and ship something was completely alien to me prior to getting to Instagram, which sounds crazy. And so it was still like very much this like studio working model where you would do design crits and then it's kind of like done when you feel like it's done. And the company was small enough such that like there wasn't a ton of like XFN work to do. You know, I could just walk over to the GM of the company and just say, this is what we're making. When you get to Instagram, especially in my case, so like when I got to Instagram, I was the entire company was still in the Menlo Park office and it was just myself in design in New York. So like I'm working on stuff and then I'm talking to my manager and I'm trying to figure out what the process is for shipping it. And it's not only is it completely alien to me that like there is a formalized review process for these things in, you know, beyond just design. It's also like completely remote. I'm presenting people who I've never even seen or met, who have no idea who they are. So that like jump between like a company where everyone who's important is someone I could just walk right up to and they're all in one room and, you know, we can just have these conversations one-on-one, to a much larger, much more like formalized process remote, was like quite a bit of, it required quite a bit of ramping up.
Were there skill gaps that you felt or areas where it's clear like you need to grow in this way pretty quickly in order to succeed in that new environment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a big one. Honestly, I think the biggest one was the storytelling and like narrative part of design. I think I always like, I think was pretty good at being able to, you know, figure out the problem, get my hands around it and like come up with something I felt was good. But being able to like explain and tell a story about why it's good and get people to believe in it was not something I like had to do previously. In some respect, it's because again, at Vine, it's like, it's small enough that like the people who are the decision makers on these things are with you the whole time. So I don't, there wasn't necessarily a lot of selling you had to do. Whereas like coming to IG, it was storytelling and narrative is probably the most important skill you could possibly have there. Being able to say like, not just this is a good idea, but like, this is a good idea. This is why we think we should do it. And it's not going to screw up, you know, all these other things we have going on. And to be able to tell that in a way that people who haven't been staring at it for 40 hours a week for the last 10 weeks can understand. That took like quite a bit of time to like ramp up and understand. And the thing is, it's like, it's hard to know what to do. You just have to see other people do it. And then you see like, oh, I see, this is what I'm not doing. And this guy's very successful at it. And I need to just like pick up what he's doing, you know?
What were some of those things that you were noticing? Like, you were at IG for roughly 5 years. Like, if you were to kind of measure yourself before and after, what were some of the ways that you think you grew as a storyteller?
The most important things that you need to have in whatever your presentation are: succinctly, what is the problem you're solving? The second thing would be ideally some evidence to say that it's a real problem and not just like something you've made up because you thought of something and you're just backing into like the idea you want to do. You want to be able to put some structure around the solution space. So you can say like, this is how we're thinking about it. Ideally, it's something where you can basically give people the ability to look at your explorations and understand the way that you're thinking about it, what you're recommending as a solution and why. And if you can do all those things pretty well, you've at least like told the right story. The other part of it that I think took some time and was very important is just being opinionated about the work. I think I had this habit of just sort of coming in with like a menu of solutions and being like, what do you think? Yeah, you want to pick one? And at Instagram, in general, at Facebook, like they're very good at not letting you take that decision off of your plate and put it onto them. So if you come in and you don't have an opinion on what's right, they'll just tell you to come back when you think you know what the right thing to do is. Then you have to come back and present why this is the right thing to do. Or what are you going to do to like to build confidence in your opinion?
Okay, I want to talk more about this. So I'm going to toss a hypothetical for you. Let's say that maybe you do have some level of like a data insight. There's something real or an opportunity. And you have like your shower thought. You have some kind of an idea that you're so excited about. You're like, I think you have some kind of a direction to run with in this problem space. Can you walk us through some of those tangible next steps that you would take to get other people in the org energized about this idea? Like practically, you open up your laptop on a Monday morning. What are you doing with this little nugget of an idea?
At least very often for me, it wasn't very often that I would start with like, that I would just like come up with like the idea. A lot of times it would, the aha moment for me would actually be less the idea and more, this sounds like ridiculous to say, but even just like getting your hands around what the problem is, like in a way that feels tangible. So as an example, for the bulk of the time that I was in IC at the company, I worked on stories consumption. So basically the viewer side of watching stories. During that whole time, the thing we're trying to drive is getting people to watch more stories. That's not a problem you can solve. Like I can't make people watch more stories because there's nothing that like, compelled them to do it. You need to understand why are they not watching stories. And once you understand why, at that point, the problem actually becomes pretty easy to solve. Like the solution becomes quite clear. But we spent the bulk of the time trying to dig into exactly what the issue is. So as a tangible example, like there was a project we worked on where we thought the issue was that the stories were too long and then people weren't able, like they were losing interest or whatever. And it wasn't until later that we realized that the issue in reality was that even though they have lots of stories available to them, their closest friends weren't posting them. And the reality is, like, that's the only person's story you're interested in. And so once you realize that's the problem, then the solution becomes a lot clearer. Like, the solution is, like, we need to get people's friends to post more. And that could be something like close friends could be a solution for that, you know, something where you limit the audience or whatever. And at that point, the process becomes, okay, like, we have the solution, we have the problem, you start designing it, you probably get it into Origami at some point, present it in a design crit, and then at some point, you'll take it to a design review. And that's usually the big barrier you need to cross, at least at Instagram. Like, design reviews are pretty hard. So if you can get buy-in from the design leadership, the rest of the approvals start to flow more easily. And then you'll move into, like, you know, probably research or testing from there.
Is there just like this graveyard of pretty interesting ideas that never shipped because they didn't make it through that last?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Especially at IG. Like, my joke was always, it's significantly harder to test things there than it is any other place I've ever worked. Once you get to a test, you have to be pretty confident. You have at least something pretty tangible to hold onto. So a lot of ideas like die before they even get to that because, you know, the story's not there or the research isn't there. I think you have to be very thoughtful about what you introduce to people because you know, you exist in people's lives in a way that's potentially very sensitive. And so you have to be very thoughtful about what you're actually getting out there, which means you often end up erring on the side of safety and a lot of stuff ends up sitting in Figma files. There are times where people in tech have the ability to delude themselves into thinking that people want something that they don't actually want because it would be better for you if you shipped it. In those situations, at least Instagram in particular was a very like, or is, principled company when it comes to decision making. And so there were lots of projects where like I sat on the review board for this like review process for basically any changes for home and profile and stories. And there is like a bunch of work that would come through there that I principally disagreed with. And I think very often when that came up, those projects just stopped or we were able to turn them into something else. But, you know, like we have things, for example, like there were projects that came through Facebook where people were floating the idea of being able to expand, like if you post a story, having it expand the audience to maybe include Facebook people. Those ideas were stopped. But like the reason why we were able to stop them is because you could talk yourself into just testing it and seeing what will happen. But like, sure, the number will go up. And it's the kind of thing where if you screw this up, you know, one time out of 100,000, like you could permanently screw up someone's life. You could like ruin someone's relationship with their family, or their spouse, whatever. It's inappropriate to like be irresponsible with it. So it's always like we were always very thoughtful about saying you have to justify this as a thing that people actually want and will improve the product for them in a way that is thoughtful and not just trying to juice a number.
Yeah, I like that. It puts an emphasis on having real vision rather than almost using testing as a crutch to kind of incrementally get there.
I mean, you know it when you see that. Like, every designer can open products and you'll see them and you'll say like, this is a product that is just the sum of 10,000 tests that did like 10% better than the alternative. And Nobody likes it. Nobody actually enjoys the thing, but it's just optimized to take advantage of your dopamine receptors, you know?
I want to talk more about that. I'm going to hold it just for a few questions. Okay. I want to kind of zoom out of a broader consumer social landscape. But I do have a specific question about early Instagram stories, because it's kind of this interesting use case where obviously Snapchat had stories and it was freaking working. Like, people liked stories. I mean, you knew that the format was there. In many ways, a lot of the core interactions had been validated. So my question is, as a design team, how did you think about or identify the right product surface areas to innovate?
That's a question. I think, at least from what I recall, like the competitive advantage we felt like we had, at least on the consumer side, was for most people, their audience was not on Snapchat, or their friends were not on Snapchat. For a certain like segment of people, like they were there or they use it occasionally, primarily younger people. But like if you were over the age of 25 at that point in time, definitely far, far more of your contacts were on Instagram. And so for most people, Instagram stories was their introduction to the format rather than Snap stories. The goal basically became like, how do we just get people to post more? Because that's the harder barrier. Like, how do we get people to see the value of this sort of transient content that like will disappear. Everything else will come afterwards, because if you can get people to post, like the fact that like it's fun to watch them and it's like fun to reply to them and it's fun to get replies, all that becomes self-evident. It's just a matter of, you know, can you start the flywheel of people giving this ecosystem a chance?
Postmore is interesting because it's such a clear metric. I think with consumer products, oftentimes you're operating at this scale where there are these like clear activation points where it kind of just does trickle down to a numbers game at the end of the day, and you're trying to move these specific needles. But then you have this interesting line that I saw you share, which is the importance of not letting data be the designer. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that a little bit and how it shapes your own philosophy as a designer?
In general, as an industry, I think we have a bit of a tendency to take a dogmatic approach to data, where I just throw four or five things out there and the one that spits out the biggest number must be better. And I think that's like an abdication of responsibility on our part. It gives you an excuse not to think. It's not to say data doesn't have value. Of course it does. Like, it will tell you the general area where a problem exists. It maybe it won't tell you exactly what the problem is, but it will tell you maybe where the gaps are. But I think actual innovation requires a bit more thought and a bit more of a creative leap to be taken. So, and also I think like just finally following the numbers will probably like lead you to a, like the kind of product we were talking about before, where it's unopinionated and nobody knows why they should be using it. And so with things like stories or like honestly any like consumer social thing where the core thing you're actually optimizing for is fun, honestly, you know, you'll use data to like get you in the ballpark, but ultimately like you kind of just need to try and get your hands around a problem that feels tangible that you can solve and then creatively problem solve for it. Like, you know, do the actual job that design is actually quite good at. Very often data is not going to actually by itself tell you the right answer there.
If data doesn't give you the answer, but it shines a light on the general ballpark that you should be looking in, what are some of the strategies that you use to then carve out where specific opportunities might exist?
I think in general, we could probably do a better concept level research. I think we have a tendency to rely more on usability research, which I think is actually not super useful. I think most designers know if something's good or not, or if it's working or not. I mean, you can tell. There's like obviously like things on the margins, but you can get in the ballpark just using your intuition on that. It's more trying to like deeply understand an issue. In the case of, we worked on something at Instagram, which ended up not shipping, but we tested this group stories concept at the time. The data told us that people didn't have good inventory, but it didn't tell us how to solve that. It didn't tell us what the actual levers of getting people to share more often were. It required us going to do research and understanding what do people get out of stories? What's the reason why they don't post? Why, for people who occasionally use stories but only post maybe once a month, like what are the barriers? Many people post stories is they only care about it being seen by maybe like 5 to 10 people and they want to have like a conversation around it. So the idea was like, can we basically set up private group stories so that just a group of people can share with each other? That was the insight that led us to that. But the data didn't actually tell us like that was a solution to a problem. It just told us, hey, there's an issue somewhere here around inventory.
I want to return to something else you said too, which is you said actual innovation requires a creative leap, which is interesting, especially when you do kind of zoom out and look at the landscape of social apps right now, because it kind of feels like every app can do everything. Yeah, it's so easy to see what's working and then copy it. And at the end of the day, you're only competing on social graph and that's it. And the result as a consumer is you get a bunch of products that look and feel largely the same. My question is, what do you think it's going to take to design the next breakthrough social app?
That's a good question. I actually don't know. I always I struggle with this quite a bit because you see, you know, there are companies that get traction and then you're exactly right that the graph is the product. And so you have something like BeReal, which, you know, was a interesting idea.
I love BeReal. And
it's great. Yeah, it's like it actually feels like to some degree, it feels a little bit like what I miss about Instagram in a lot of respects. But then not enough people post, and then so you post less, and then so you check less, and then you post less, and you end up in this death spiral. And you see this with a lot, like, you know, Laps did this, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Laps next, yeah.
What was the one? Dispo? Same thing. It's like, you know, it's ultimately, like, the thing you need to differentiate is you need some sort of escape velocity with audience. I guess, like, TikTok is probably the most recent one that was able to really achieve escape velocity in anything even remotely approaching social, and, you know, yeah, that could just be because like it basically landed here with a tremendous audience already. So even that feels like a little bit of a cheat code. And I guess in that case, like the actual innovation was just the algorithm was just very, very good. And the algorithm isn't something you can just, it's not a format, you know, it's tech. So social in general is a tough place to like create, well, at least like creatively innovate and not be swallowed up. In general, I think the like our industry could do better at more creative innovation, but social in particular is like a very, very difficult space right now.
Yeah, I saw a tweet, I think maybe even yesterday, from Greg Eisenberg that was basically calling for the next breakout social app. And I, in general, am such an optimist. Like, I want to believe that the future is only going to keep getting better. It's difficult to see the path forward in social right now. It really is. Like, it kind of feels a little bit like there was a heck of a lot of opportunity in the beginning when all of the graphs were being laid, and now they're kind of cemented. And I mean, you're right. Like, Dispo. I remember when Dispo came out, and it was like going through that onboarding for the first time, and it's like, man, this is so creative. So creative. And you're rooting for it, and you want it to succeed. And then it's like 6 months later, it's like, where did this go?
I always think about this because this is, I guess, a bit of a less of a thing now. But at least while I was at IG, I felt like that was the period of time where Congress was really cracking down on, or attempting to crack down on, places like Facebook and things like that for monopolizing like social products. And obviously, like, I'm sympathetic to that to some degree, but it also feels like it could only be replaced by another monopoly. Like, nobody wants 10 different networks. Like, you kind of just want the one that does the thing that you want it to do. And obviously we'll end up having a couple, but more so than other industries, like, again, because the network is the product, it's very hard to shift the network. The network always wants to congregate in one place. And so, yes, you could always, like, you know, throw some restrictions on a Facebook or a TikTok or whatever it is, but then it'll just pop up on something else, and eventually it'll like coalesce around like one product again, just by the nature of what it is.
I want to throw another hypothetical your way, which is a little bit of like a David and Goliath. Like, you mentioned Laps. That is a product that I've kind of been giving a chance, and we'll link it in the show notes. It is really cool. Let's say, hypothetically, you accept a role as the head of design at Laps. Super early stage, you are tasked with making it something that lasts. What are the qualities of the design culture that you would want to create? And what traits would you be looking for in candidates that you're hiring when you're building this team?
First of all, shout out to the previous head of design at Laps. I'm very sorry that you lost your job in this scenario. To me, you are a better designer than I am. I think in terms of the culture, probably like related to some of the things we've been talking about, this sort of culture of like storytelling and narrative and being principled and taking big swings like on creative ideas, I think is what leads to a better product overall. I think that's like the right design culture. In terms of design's role in the company, a company like Laps is the perfect stage for this kind of thing, but you really want to try, in my opinion, set up design in the role of design to not just be an arm of product, which I think is what ends up happening in most companies. And once that's set in stone, it's very hard to unwind that. I really think of design really more as a partner team there. And so that means that, like, yeah, when product writes a PRD, for example, like, you're not handing a designer a solution, you're handing them a problem. Design's job is to go find the solution to it. The ability for design to stop work that they don't agree with or that they don't think is going to lead to a better outcome for people, having that set up initially, I think is very important. In terms of what I would look for in designers, I think probably the hardest thing I think to teach designers is that sort of product thinking, you know, skill and that like creative problem solving skill. The other things like visual design, interaction design, like obviously it's great if you can do it and you want like some baseline competency there, but like I can teach someone good visual design. I could teach someone origami or whatever as part of like the Facebook design process. And honestly, I think at most places now they do like the whiteboarding exercise, and far and away, that was always the one that told me the most about whether or not this person would be successful.
Can I double click on that? What were you looking for in those moments?
The playbook is a little bit out on that type of test. And so I think, you know, at some point, I think schools started teaching to the test. And so you see people now who come in and they do, you know, they have a process and they build personas and they like have this like very structured idea of what they're going to walk through. And I never cared about that at all. The only thing I cared about was upfront that you have the ability to at least come up with some coherent problem for the thing we're trying to solve. I care that your solution is intentional, that it like speaks to the problem you're solving, and that it's creative. I actually don't care at all that it's good. I care that it's creative and smart. As an example, like as funny, I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday about what her problem solving exercise was at when she got hired at IJ. The prompt she was given was design ATM. I think if the average person were to walk in and get that prompt, what they would do is say like, okay, the problem with an ATM is that the interface is difficult to use. And so then they just redesign the interface. And you start from the place of it's still a box, it's still a touch screen, and this is how it looks, and it spits out money like this. Her idea was, actually the hardest part of an ATM is that it sucks finding ATMs. And so her idea was, what if you could go into any bodega with a QR code and you just show them the QR code and they give you cash in hand and they get paid on the back end by the bank? Which, like, listen, is that a great idea in practice? I don't know, probably not. Is it easier to find a bodega than it is an ATM? Probably not. But it's a very interesting, intentional solution to a problem. And it shows a kind of creativity that I don't think like the average person on the street could bring to the table.
It says a lot about a candidate. And I think there's probably somebody listening to this and they're inspired by this. They want to grow in this area. And yet it's like a very wishy-washy thing at the end of the day. So maybe you can even speak to your own journey a little bit or any other general advice that you have. Like, how do you think designers can grow this muscle of creative problem solving?
I think we have this tendency to very quickly want to get to a solution. It's like, it's very scary to like work in the abstract. But what that often means is that you start with the most tightly constrained idea in your head. And then you just start making that. And I think that's how you end up with the safest version of an idea. And so being able to make the abstract part of problem solving somewhat structured and like easy to get your hand around and like hold in your mind, I've always found that very helpful in terms of being able to come up with something creative that is maybe not something that would be totally apparent to you up front. I also think like to some degree, like it just comes with reps in like the right space to work in. I'm often very critical of things like sprints, but I think they are very good about in working in that kind of problem area. If you have like an abstract enough problem, then the space and like the ask to go do something that is free of the constraints of like, what could we build in 2 weeks, or what are the dependencies on it, or things like that, I think is very helpful. So yeah, it's like to some degree, I think there's a process and there's a process solution to it. But I think a lot of it is just like getting the reps in and like being in a position to actually try and do that work. I do think for what it's worth, that is probably like the most important part of the work in general right now. My sense is that the sort of purely execution focused designer is going to be less relevant as time goes on. And so this kind of abstract thinking, I think, is going to be the most important skill a designer can have moving forward.
Can you go a little bit deeper on that? What do you mean by execution designer being less relevant moving forward?
Like if the thing that you're good at is you can pump out ideas, quickly with like some level of craft and quality, but they're very straightforward ideas. They need a sign-up flow. And so you need to pump out, a couple of different forms and to map it out, whatever. Very quickly, that is going to be commoditized just by virtue of like, I think Figma is already making this like this sort of commoditization a lot more easy. Like AI at some point, like we'll reach a point where people are able to connect LLMs to their company's design system. And then you'll have PMs being able to say, give me a sign-up flow. It needs to do X, Y, and Z. And they'll put out something that's pretty close. Could you do something? Yes. Like something better? Probably. Yes. But it's probably going to be close enough that it's going to be less important. Being able to own this more abstract thinking is, I think, a much more valuable skill and much more difficult skill to develop. But I think it will be the thing that differentiates thoughtful, creative designers from just like a PM with Figma,
Not to overuse the cliche thinking outside the box, but I am still kind of subconsciously processing this ATM example. And I think what makes it really interesting is it's almost redrawing the boundaries of the box. And you're right. Like I've been playing with a lot of the different AI tools. And like once you have that box defined, it does feel like a lot of the at least early ideation work that we're going to be doing is prompt and then select from a list of 8 relatively decent options and then iterate on it super fast. Like I've already done that with some success. Even in the last like 3 weeks, it feels like there's a tipping point where some of these new tools are like, okay, this is getting pretty close. So yeah, I like the ATM example because the real skill is figuring out where do I draw this box to even point this new wave of tools at? And that kind of more abstract level of product strategy is very, very interesting. And even reflecting on some of the times where I feel like I made the biggest impact as a designer is where, like, I actually looked at a PRD and said, you know what, this isn't even really the right PRD to be talking about. Like, if we zoom out and actually connect these two ideas, there's something much more interesting here.
The interface that's on the screen with the QR code, yeah, we could pump that out with some sort of with AI or something like that super quickly. That's not the idea. Like, once you got there, the idea is already done. Like you're already 95% of the way there. The hard part was everything that got you there. And like, you wouldn't even know how to prompt an LLM to get you to that without already understanding what the solution is. It's like, it's a level of like abstraction that is very difficult to get your hands around. Your example of like the PRD, like of being able to like look at it and be like, actually, I don't think this is even the right problem. I think that's like a super valuable skill. I think that's like, you know, something like that saves a company, you know, what, 3-6 months of time to just be able to say, like, I can look at this right now and tell you we're not even looking at the problem. You know, it's like that scene in Moneyball. It's like, not like that. You're not even looking at the problem. You know?
I think that a lot of times I ask questions about product sense or creative problem solving, and the default answer is kind of reps. And I get it. It's totally a reps thing where you just have to kind of go put in the work and get better each time. I want to ask it one different way, though, because you're at the point now in your career where you have a lot of reps, mm-hmm. and yet you're not stagnant. You're still growing as a product designer and developing specifically a deeper level of product sense and understanding like what works and what you can notice from other products even. So can you talk a little bit more about like what are the ways that you are investing in your own personal product sense at this later stage in your career?
The thing that's been the biggest accelerant of like my ability has been the transition to management. There's definitely some rust in terms of like the actual hard skills, but the ability you have to develop to being able to look at a bunch of products or a bunch of different ideas at any given time and like context switch and within like a couple minutes, like understand what they're trying to do and being able to see through it and see like, this is either working or it's not working. And I need to be able to articulate why in such a way that they can actually then go execute against it has made me a significantly better designer. Such that if I were to go back to IC work now, like, you're always going to have to figure out how to prototype in Figma. Cause
I was about to say, crack open origami. Brittle. Here we go.
Yeah. I will be back in origami so fast. I'll have to learn some of those things, but I would be a significantly better IC now than I was when I stopped and made the transition to make that much more actionable. I do think even just being an active participant in things like Crit and trying to force yourself to understand like deeply the problem that someone else is trying to solve and develop this muscle of being able to just understand like at a glance if something's working or not working. Like, I know like my personal experience in things like Crit is like they'll show the work and I'll know pretty immediately whether or not we're in the right ballpark. If I think we're not in the right ballpark, I may not know immediately why. It might take me like a couple minutes of sitting with it and thinking about it and trying to understand like what is not working here. What is the thing I need to help them to push on to like get to a better place? But I'll know within seconds like, okay, this isn't it. Like, we're not here yet. And like, that's a thing that you just... You know, it does take time to develop, but like things like Crit, things like watching other people present, like there are lots of opportunities to start to develop that skill without you having to be the one doing it. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be you doing the presentation. It doesn't have to be you doing the Crit. It's just you have exposure to it. You just have to like be an active participant in it.
Let's drill into the management track a little bit more. Like, what are some of the ways that your time at IG changed your perspective on design leadership?
In particular, I think Ian Swalter is a very, very good example of a design leader to like model your career on. He's like ability to make not just like designers care about the product and design as a discipline, but also to get like the rest of the company to invest in design as a thing that just like felt good and felt important and made you proud to work on it. It's very impressive. It's sort of like almost a thing that I didn't realize you could even do. I think like prior to IG, like to some degree with Vine, but then especially working in studios, like design always felt sort of cool to us, you know, but very subordinate to the capital B business. I think in particular, like Spalter's leadership showed you that like that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. You can make a very compelling argument for design being a differentiator and something that is valuable to everyone and can like create this culture of just celebrating good work and design just to its own end. I think, for example, like he was very good at like bringing in either artists or bringing back work from like Biennale or stuff like that, where it's very tangentially related to product design, but it's a thing that makes you care about craft and quality and, you know, and just like good work.
Before I let you go, I have two quick hitting questions for you. The first is, what's a piece of feedback that you've received in your career that really stuck with you and impacted your path as a designer?
I remember there was this one time in particular at IG, I was like getting very frustrated about like this like project wasn't coming together. And like, I think I was waiting on like a product brief or something from the PM. And I think I was complaining to my manager at the time about it, probably like being like a child. And she was like, I don't know, man, sounds like you let him block you. And I was basically like, well, like, listen, like, I can't start the design until we do this. And she was like, why not? It's the only thing we can do. It's the only thing you're good at. And it's like, it is true. It's like, you know, as designers, we basically have one arrow in the quiver. It's design. So just go do it. Just go, if you don't have like a good sense of the problem, like go design stuff that will help you figure out the problem. If you say like, well, we're waiting on this decision and it's like a binary thing, like then go try both, go design both versions of it now. And see how it feels. You have the ability to drive the conversation because you can, you are the first person who can make the conversation tangible. So just go do it. Like there's always a reason to not get it started, but like the reality is you just have to get comfortable working in ambiguity.
Last question is, what's something that you personally believe about design that you think a lot of other designers might disagree with?
I think probably my most controversial opinion here potentially is I think in some respects, Figma as a design tool, as good as it is making it more difficult for people to be creative designers. The easiest path for people now is just to like swap in components and like move them around on the screen, which is very helpful when you're working on like a tangible design problem. But I, in my personal experience, like I talk to people now and I think I'll ask a designer to do like 10 versions of this thing. And then they'll come back with basically 10 versions of the same idea, just with the components swapped around. I guess like prompt would be to basically detach all instances and break all the auto layout, at least if you are in the early stages of an idea, and just make a mess and then clean it up later. We can get it back into auto layout. We can bring it back into the design system. But like to some degree, the improvement of the tools has made us better at being conductors of a conveyor belt of design and less good at the sort of like more fun, creative part of the job. It's definitely like put us in a box in some regards.
We're kind of coming full circle back to this core idea of developing the knee-jerk reaction to zoom out as a designer.
Yeah.
Rich, this has been amazing. You've given me a ton to think about. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your ideas with us.
Yeah, totally, man. Thank you for having me. I love talking to you.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.